Welcome to the Sum of It All Universal Design for Learning podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're exploring the third edition of UDL Now, A Teacher's Guide to Applying Universal Design for Learning by Katie Novak. Transcripts to our podcast are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're kicking off with Chapter 3. Differentiating between universal design for learning and differentiated instruction. And if I was trying to sum up the chapter in just a few words, I'd probably say that UDL works to consider variability ahead of time in the planning of a lesson, while differentiation works to respond to variability in the lesson, like during implementation. But I think we need to do more than just have kind of like a brief statement about it. And we really need to dive into these ideas because they're way more complex than that.
Great point, Audrey. I have a thought as we get into this episode. Tell me what you think about this. You know, in the first couple episodes, we mentioned connections to teaching and learning mathematics through, you know, considering universal design for learning. We mentioned it, the idea of application to mathematics a few times, Audrey. But, you know, most of our time we spent like talking in this general space about, you know, the benefits of adopting UDL as an approach and meeting the needs of each and every learner. So what I was wondering is, we get into this episode, Audrey, maybe it would be helpful to our listeners to be a little bit more intentional regarding mathematics throughout the episode. What do you think?
Yes, I think let's make sure we do that this time.
Fantastic. So, you know, I'm going to start with a quote that Katie has in the chapter. And she says, "My understanding of how UDL and differentiated instruction work together has grown exponentially." And I just want to start by saying, Audrey, I love how Katie is so reflective about her growth between these different editions of this book. And she gets very specific even, which is even more helpful. She says, "I used to say reactive, now I say responsive." You know, just the way that she thinks about how we intervene, if you will, as we try to make sure everyone is supported. And, you know, as I think about it, Audrey, in our last episode, you mentioned the instructional move of providing a choice of numbers during a math lesson. Remember that?
Yeah,
how,
I do.
How that's a particular move that we might make instructionally. If students have a problem in context, for example, and then students can choose which number set to use to lower their own barrier. And you know what I started thinking about, though? Is that a UDL move or is that a differentiated instruction move?
Oh, interesting question. Okay, let's think about that. So if I've put together some number choices for my students ahead of time, like on a word problem or something that we're going to be discovering, I think if I'm doing that ahead of time and thinking about my variability of my students ahead of time, I think that's UDL. I think that's planning for the variability of my students. And if my students are picking the number that best fits their strengths and needs in that moment, then they're really being an expert learner, which is, again, this part of this universal design for learning. But I think in the moment, if you walk over and you tell a student, "Try this number," right? Or, "Looks like you're struggling, try this one instead," right? Then that feels like differentiation to me. That feels like in the moment you're having to like guide a student. And so I feel like the real question behind this might be, who's doing the work and when is the work happening, right? So like teachers taking it on and telling students to do something versus students. And it's not as cut and dry as that, but maybe there's a distinction there. And sure. to the end of this, Mark, like, I appreciate us having a conversation about which it is, but I don't think the purpose, let me say that this way. I don't think we want to get lost in precise identification always in our moves and being like, that was UDL or that was differentiated instruction. And not because it's not important to know the difference, but this reminds me about like the Standards for Mathematical Practice, the SMP.
Oh yeah, sure.
And when they came out, people were like, "Are you doing SMPs in class?" And people were like, "Yeah." And they're like, "Well, which ones?" And so we had all these different tools to like identify which ones were happening in class. And the purpose of that was to not just brush it off and say like, "I'm doing it, like it's happening," but to be able to really articulate, like, what does it mean to be thinking like a mathematician? What are the choices? What are the student moves? What are the things that are going on in their heads? How do we look at it that way? But it's not about getting so far into like the Bill McCollum things of like a precise identification of the birds. Like that's not the intent of it. The intent is not that someone walks in and goes, that was S&P 1 or that was S&P 7. The intent is that kids are engaged in the practices, right? And I think the same thing is true of UDL and differentiated instruction. They are both there as part of approaches that we do in our classroom design and implementation in order to support the variability of our learners. So like whether it's one or the other might be less important than it's actually there. But if you're just saying, yeah, it's there, that maybe we need to go back and say like, is it, which one are you doing in this moment? Kind of a yin and yang of like going back to balance those two thoughts.
Yeah, I really appreciate, Audrey, how you sort of portrayed that messiness of how there's overlap between those two. I also appreciated you bringing out sort of the power differential between teacher and student, who's doing the work. I think those two things are things that we should continue to consider as we go forward in this discussion. Hey, you know, one other thing that I should give a shout out for, Katie actually has a good resource she filmed a few years ago, and she does a dinner party analogy of the difference between a UDL versus differentiation. And for our listeners, if you Google Katie Novak and dinner party, you will come up with that pretty short YouTube video. I found that to be pretty helpful as well.
That's a great one. So along those lines, like people usually at a dinner party are not being served things for themselves. Like she does these buffet things and making sure people have the choice and autonomy to choose what's right for them. So she has this quote on page 50 back in the education land saying, educators need to use frequent formative assessments to determine if students are making responsible decisions that lead them to accessible and engaging learning and positive outcomes. And I think that just is that continual pushback to like, we're developing students to be expert learners, to be able to navigate all kinds of learning situations. And in order to do that, the autonomy has to land on the student to make those decisions at some point, right? Like we have to grow them into that, right? And saying like, why did you choose those numbers? Recognizing you do have strengths with things that are evens or multiples of four or fives or whatever. That's great. And I like how you also challenge yourself to pick these numbers because they're numbers you're not as strong in, right? And looking at that, recognizing it, and continuing to do kind of that formative check to see if that's happening in your class is important.
Yeah, you know, Audrey, as we're talking about this word formative, and the phrase formative assessments, I have to say that sort of triggers a little bit for me because I had in my learning over the years, I've learned the idea of something being formative, meaning that it's only formative if I use the data to inform my work with students. So in other words, otherwise it's just a piece of paper that I gave my students. And so I think it's really interesting to think about formative data. The other thing that comes to mind is what happens in elementary classrooms in terms of groupings. I think that sometimes in the past and even currently, some of this data has been used to get us into trouble in mathematics. I think about elementary students as young as kindergarten or first grade that are given some sort of assessment, whether you want to call it formative or summative, and students are labeled regarding what they cannot do based on that assessment context. And so, you know, often this data is used to judge students even before they arrive in the next classroom. And there's this belief that I believe is just hardwired into our system that past performance is a predictor of future success in mathematics. So if my past success has gaps, whatever words we want to use for that, that's going to determine whether I can be successful as a mathematician going forward. And this really makes the quote that Katie includes by Wu on page 52 just so, I think, relevant to what we're talking about, Audrey. I'll read it real quick. In effectively differentiated classrooms, then, teachers would flexibly group students, sometimes based on readiness needs, sometimes on interests, sometimes on approach to learning, sometimes heterogeneously, sometimes homogeneously, sometimes by teacher choice, sometimes by student choice, sometimes randomly. That variety of grouping enhances both teaching and learning.
Yeah, that's a great quote, Mark. And the first thing I think of when you read that is about intervention practices at secondary levels, right? Like they are not flexibly grouped. They are not sometimes heterogeneous and sometimes homogeneous, or sometimes by teacher choice or sometimes by student. Like that's not, there's something broken there, I guess. And so I think sometimes I appreciate the like notion that like we have to think about this in a more dynamic space instead of a static space. Like it is not an intervention label for long term, right? This is like a momentary need, and acknowledging again that variability is different in different contexts. So we've landed in a context where there is a need for some additional support, right? But that's not necessarily going to be the same in 2 weeks on a warm day versus a cold day, like when we're talking about beverages, right? Like there's, it just changes. And so all of this goes back to say, like, I want to make sure that when we are thinking about our groups and intervening and thinking about what our data is telling us, that we're really thinking about the kind of classroom we're trying to fix. And Katie has this beautiful quote where she says, you're never going to intervene your way out of tier one, weak tier one. And it might be helpful for us just to talk about like what kind of math class is it that we're trying to do this intervention or try to support these groupings in?
Yeah, Audrey, you and I are thinking along the same lines. I even the question comes to mind, what math classroom are we UDLing? I know that's maybe not a word, but, you know, and in page 53, Katie talks about this kind of this historical notion of how we began inclusion for students in the margins. And something to consider here is like, even when we did that, right, when we started making, and we're still doing that, that we're certainly not done there. As we're doing that, like, are we including them into classrooms that the goal is to mimic the teacher? Because if that's the goal in the classrooms that we're including students that are marginalized, Audrey, I just have to admit, I just think that's a setup.
It is, you know, and so like when you have parents and families and community members who are saying like, I'm against inclusion. Like I think sometimes at the heart of it, and Katie notices this in one of the quotes in her, in this chapter, is that they're advocating for what their students need. So if you're telling me you want to include my child in this type of setting, and yet I'm looking at that setting and saying, you're setting my child up for failure, right? Like there's no way I'm going to be for it. There's no way I'm going to advocate. I'm going to say, no, I want separate services that help my child succeed. And whether that's because they need additional support or more enrichment, or they need faster, they need slower, like any end of whatever complex spectrum you can design, like our parents, our families, our communities are going to try to continue to advocate for their child getting what they need. And so if we're not offering that in that tier one class, we're going to continue to have people advocating for different services for different kids.
I think that's really well put, Audrey. I actually had never thought about it that way. And I think that's profound and super, super helpful for me and for our listeners. Well said. So really, like, what I'm kind of getting to with this discussion is, like, if we want UDL to be a successful approach in mathematics, and we want it to be something that helps us be more successful to support our students in the margins, I really feel like this word freedom just really comes to my mind. Like freedom in a mathematics classroom, because I don't think that word traditionally goes with learning math, versus this more traditional atmosphere where I know I've mentioned it before, but it's this power differential. The power is in the hands of the teacher. And the opposite, I think, is this freedom.
Yeah. Okay. So I can go with that, but what would that look like? Can you give an example? Like, what does that look like in a math class?
Yeah. Yeah, super, super fair question, Audrey. And I know half of our listeners just asked the same one.
Yeah.
Sounds great, Mark, but like,
what does it look like?
That's fair. Well, one that comes to mind, and Katie mentioned it in the chapter, and I think you even maybe mentioned it earlier, is this notion of flexible groupings. You know, one of the ways that we can create more freedom is to not lock kids into groupings where you're a quote unquote low math student and you shall always be in my little buddy group. to use an elementary phrase, right? So something I tried in my fifth grade classroom is that when we were engaged in some learning over a period of a few days, maybe a week, I might have some way of formatively gathering data around how students are understanding a particular topic. And then I noticed that some students need some additional support. So by inviting those students into a small group just around that concept, not as a degree of permanence, but just as a just-in-time type of a support, I found that that was something that didn't stigmatize kids and allow them to not be constrained in that group. I also tried one other thing. I also invited anyone that wanted to come join that group. They could join that group as well. So I found that I think I could do it much better, of course. But I think that that degree of freedom was there as well as where other kids, it was not something that only certain kids needed to come to that time. And then for the next week, we're on to a different concept. Could be something different. So that's something that comes to mind, Audrey.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate even the notion that, like, as we're developing expert learners, choose if you feel like this is something you're a little more shaky than I'm recognizing as your teacher, come on over and let's talk about it. All right, so we're dancing around kind of this really hot button topic though. And Katie goes there, I don't know if we should, but she talks about tracking. This might just up our listenership, or we might just lose all of our listeners right now. I'm not sure, but should we go there for a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it.
I'm ready. Hey, I'm going to start from a phrase that I'm not sure I've used this phrase before, but Katie had it in the chapter, and it's wonderful to get into this complicated world of tracking in terms of mathematics. And here's the phrase: teaching and learning are not transactional. Like, if you do this, you get this. And in terms of what math you get to learn. So I'm gonna be honest with you and our listeners. There have been times, Audrey, that I've been on a campus and I've walked into an advanced class in mathematics, so-called labeled advanced class, and versus a non-advanced class that I also walked in. Audrey, there was a palatable difference in the actual atmosphere, the feeling in the room, actually for me as an adult. And I couldn't get in the minds of all the students in that room, each of those rooms, but it was a palatable difference. And I can't help but just express how unequal of a playing field that is. So, I mean, it begs the question, right? Like, how did we get here? How do we get in this situation where we have two different types of learning environments and all these kids are in the same grade?
Yeah, you know, that's what I'm sitting here thinking about, Mark. Like, how did we end up here? And, you know, I have to think that some of the responsibility for where this comes from, you know, there's companies out there that have these things they call universal screeners, and there's stuff in accountability reports and other spaces that ask what universal screeners are you using, right? And what data are you looking at to help serve your students? And I'm not going to speak for other content areas, but I'm going to think specifically around the mathematics universal screeners. I'm going to say I don't actually think they're actually universal screeners. I think they are assessments around really specific topics in mathematics that are set up for some students to achieve and for other students to not, and to thereby get your different levels, you know, big air quotes on levels of abilities of your students.
Yeah, great point, Audrey. And I wonder, like, how are those assessments sharing with us how our students can engage in the standards for mathematical practice? If that's what we want our students engaged in, we need assessments that help us really start to see how kids are engaged in thinking. And one example that does come to mind, Kathy Richardson, who has marvelous tools in early primary grades for mathematics, and of course, Marilyn Burns, each of those folks has developed some different student interviewing tools in terms of getting at students' thinking and how are they thinking about particular concepts. And I just think that that type of angle seems to be something that would get more at the thinking of how kids are thinking, not just can they do this one isolated skill and then somehow they're just sent into a path of remediation, right?
You know, which makes me begin to like think about like if we have these assessments that continue to have certain groups of students perform and student groups not perform at or above the level of expectation, that's discrimination, right? Like that shouldn't happen in natural variability of people and individuals and society. Like, so something's wrong with the screener. And I think we have to figure out another way that we can really examine the diversity of assets and abilities around this whole expectation that we're saying we're going to hold on to with variability if we're going to get anywhere with this, right? Because otherwise we're going to continue to perpetuate these inequitable practices and these discriminatory practices over and over and over again.
You're absolutely right, Audrey. I mean, we really have to start with the assessments, the tools that we're using to end up with these groupings where it ends up with those classrooms that I walk in that just seems so very different. We really have to go back and address that. And that what that really makes me think about is another quote that is included in this chapter. And it goes like this: equitable classrooms are classrooms where the student body in all its beautiful variability is represented. Wow. I just want to put math right into that quote, right?
Yeah. Like
equitable math classrooms are classrooms where the student body in all its beautiful variability is represented. But yes, we need to ask the question, what does that look and sound like, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So number, like, it should look and sound like any classroom you walk into feels the same and looks like a good representation of your student body. And if that's not true, there's some real hard questions you need to be asking. But in the context of like the actual lesson, like I'm thinking about how in secondary mathematics, we have gotten into a rut of warm up examples, excuse me, and then lecture. I'm going to, you know, talk to you about those examples. And now you go try those examples, right? And that's not considering whether or not a student needs an example first, or if they need an example that they can pause and rewind or pause and do some thinking and then go back to, like maybe something that's maybe on demand instead of a teacher live in front of them. And that like all of these things is like comes back to this idea that I hear teachers over and over say like, my students just aren't paying attention or they're not taking good notes, right? That's the barrier. Right. When in fact, like, we're designing this for a very, very narrow number of students. And we're not designing this for the variability that like most of the time when we need new things, we're not going to learn at the same rate as everyone else, that we're going to need certain things repeated and other people are going to need other things repeated, that we're going to need time to dabble in it ourselves and then go back and consult a source again. Like all of those pieces don't seem to be met when we kind of fill out this standard protocol in our math classes.
Yeah, Audrey, that phrase paying attention is just staying with me. I've used that phrase myself. I've heard many of my colleagues say, if my kids would just pay attention, without us sort of considering that engagement principle, like, why aren't they paying attention? What is that barrier? Audrey, for another practical suggestion, I'm going to reach back to one of our previous seasons. Remember when we read Kathy Seeley's book, Faster Isn't Smarter? Mm-hmm. There was a chapter in that book called Upside Down Teaching. And I really like this as a baby step type of move I can make as a teacher in my classroom. And the move that she suggests is, if you have that sort of demo time in the beginning of the lesson, that lecture, that mini lecture, whatever you're going to do to demonstrate for students, she suggests taking that and just moving it to the end of the lesson. And I just really appreciate that idea of a barrier being lowered, of kids being able to engage in the mathematics first. There's still being that teaching by the instructor, if the instructor feels like they need to hold on to that. But that's coming after they're able to make some meaning, so that the teacher's things they're going to say on the front end, they will have more context at the end of the lesson. So that seems to connect to what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, it does. And I appreciate that just real practical step of something to try. So there's just a couple things sticking with me as we're wrapping up this episode is like, it's not a, do I do universal design for learning or do I differentiate instruction? We need both. Right. And if we're doing that well, we really can start to dismantle some of our inequitable practices that we've developed over time, like tracking and grouping students, right?
Right.
But that it sounds like we might need to take some more time to really think about or to keep going back to what does UDL look and sound like, and what does differentiated instruction look and sound like when we're talking about this inquiry math classroom where students are thinking and not mimicking,
right?
And not just placing these approaches onto our antiquated mathematics classrooms and instructional practices.
I agree. Thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 4, Recruiting and Engaging Learners as UDL Partners. Until then, send us a tweet with the hashtag SumMathChat. That's hashtag SumMathChat with your questions and thoughts. We'll keep the conversation going there. Until then, best wishes on rethinking our practices.